Support comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Join us this week is E.J. McMahon, an adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute and research director of the Empire Center for Public Policy, an independent, nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank based in Albany. He writes on regional, state, and local issues, recommending policy changes and reforms to increase economic growth. Welcome, E.J. McMahon.
Hi.
Okay. Tell us about the economic condition of New York State. Are we in a bad spot now?
Well, yes. The state, as of December at least, which is the most recent figures, the state was still down almost 1 million private sector jobs from a year earlier. Mm-hmm. The jobs recovery from the even worse decline in, immediately after the pandemic started, that recovery stalled in December. It's not clear that it has picked up since then. As you know, the epicenter of the coronavirus crisis and the impact of the shutdowns was New York City and the New York City metropolitan area, where basically the tourism industry, for instance, collapsed. The Manhattan Business District has gone essentially dark. The entertainment values, venues are closed, et cetera. And so a lot of jobs were lost when that happened. A lot of activity has ceased, but at the suburbs of New York City, somewhat less so, but still severely affected. The major upstate metro areas, which is a relative term, but the major upstate ones are the cities Albany, the Albany, Schenectady, Troy area, Rochester, Syracuse, Buffalo. They're all down quite a bit too. Buffalo somewhat less, but there's been a decline across the board. We have the biggest job loss. We have the second largest job loss year to year of any state except Hawaii, Hawaii being tiny and having lost most of its tourism. And it's, you know, the outlook is that with all the forecasters are saying, well, as soon as the restrictions are off, as soon as the everything is lifted, which everybody hopes will be this summer, that there will be a really strong bounce back. But we have further to go. So that's where we are right now.
EJ, whose fault is it?
Whose fault is the economic decline?
Yes.
The economic decline is related to the restrictions on economic activity. Right. Restrictions on economic activity were imposed by the governor in response to the pandemic. Now, the interesting thing is that when you get away from all the particulars, Governor Cuomo was essentially part of a crowd of public officials across the country who failed to anticipate what was coming soon enough. In his case, the impact was worse here because New York was the point where we were taking in an intense form of the virus, of the virus that originated in China via Europe in early in the year, probably January, if not even December. And the infection was growing and being planted throughout the first 2 months of the year. And that was not being recognized and anticipated, but not just by him, by people in general. So one could pick apart the exact week that more should have been done. But clearly, once the restrictions were imposed, which started with a broad lockdown, that shut down the economy. And shutting down the economy created the economic impact we have now. Retaining restrictions, particularly on indoor dining downstate, has simply increased the pain and delayed the recovery, I would say. And there's a lot of controversy over that, obviously.
So would somebody else have done better than Cuomo?
Well, I can tell you where somebody would have, could have, should have done better and where he definitely should have done better. And it's an area that's getting no attention and where he actually had an advantage over just about every other governor in the country. And that is financially. A year ago this week, this very week, was when we got the first clear economic warning shot of the trouble with the coronavirus, very clearly. It was a year ago this week, the last week in February of 2020, that the stock market had a crash. It went down 10% in 1 week, the stock market indexes. This was the steepest drop in the shortest period of time, actually since before the Great Recession, in terms of how quickly it happened. The market had peaked February 8, you know, I think 18th or 17th, and it went down 10% this week a year ago. That had obvious implications for the New York State budget. Now, what else happened a year ago this week? The budget director and the legislative fiscal committee chairs held their annual economic and revenue forecasting conference in the middle of that week when the crash was already happening. And by the way, I would invite you or anybody listening, go back, search the news archives for a year ago this week, and you'll see it was widely reported. It was headline news, and it was all related to the coronavirus. That was what was unfolding then. So in New York, of course, our fiscal year starts April 1st, which is 3 months sooner than almost any other state. Yeah. So he was about to begin serious budget negotiations. They had the consensus conference, which is supposed to result in a consensus on what revenues are going to be. They issued their consensus statement on the Sunday, March 1st, following this worst stock market week in a long time. What did they agree on? They agreed that there'd be $700 million more than they originally thought in revenue. I mean, I'm not just saying I told you so. At the time I wrote about this and talked about how crazy this was. Then the governor began then having press availabilities, although one of his first after this was his press conference with de Blasio, I think within the week, where you may recall they jointly urged everybody to stay cool and it won't be a big deal. Okay, look, they were no worse than Trump at that point. I mean, you know, it was a big deal. But he did not do anything financially about this. I think that a week or so afterwards in a press conference, he was asked, well, the stock market just crashed. Doesn't that have implications for the budget? His answer, which I'm closely paraphrasing, was, well, yeah, of course, that's a big deal for us. But, you know, if I could predict the stock market, I'd be in another business. Who knows? Well, that was not an answer. OK, here's the problem he had. After the 30-day period to amend the budget is over, he doesn't control the budget bills. The budget bills are what he last proposed, which were $10 billion more than they could afford. Did he publicly at the time, showing leadership, announce that we have to go back and reopen the budget? I'm urging the legislature. We must make changes to our expenditure outlook in line with what's happening now to our economy? The answer is no, he didn't. He didn't do anything. He didn't talk about the budget at all. The word never came up. On the budget deadline, they passed a budget that made two concessions, precisely two, to, at this point, late March, was the bottom falling out, an absolute economic and fiscal crash across the board. What did they do? Instead of increasing school aid in the budget, as projected, they froze it. And the other thing was they passed a clause that said that if the governor thinks there's going to be a deficit, he has the unusual power to make across-the-board cuts of up to 20% in local assistance spending. Across the board, it stipulated. At that point, and then he proceeds to announce that the budget is passed, congratulates the legislature for passing the budget, and in the same breath says the budget spends $10 billion more than they have, and the federal government is simply going to have to give it to us. And from that point on, for the rest of the year, up until now, he's been using two or three different sets of numbers, sound familiar, about what the actual financial status of the state is. He's demanded again and again that the feds fill whatever budget hole we have, which he variously describes as $14 billion, $15 billion, or at times over $60 billion. He specifically and explicitly acknowledged that during one of his many, many availabilities over the summer that he was not taking steps to reduce spending because he didn't want Congress to think we didn't need the money he was demanding from them. Mm-hmm. Now, you can whatever you want to call this, whether you think this is strategically wise or not, that's not leadership in a fiscal sense. He basically did as little as he could possibly get away with, while demanding again and again that the feds give him an enormous amount of unrestricted money. He, by the way, his own budget documents acknowledged that the state government, just the state, has received categorical aid in the past year totaling $27 billion, just the state, not the localities or public authorities or individuals. There's a lot of money that has flowed here, a big pile of money. He got $5 billion plus in December from the lame duck Congress, including the Republican Senate. He now is in line to get $12.7 billion in unrestricted aid from the federal government, which would be by far the largest amount of unrestricted aid the state has ever received from the federal government for any reason. And he's still saying it's not enough. He's demanding he gets no less than $15 billion, which is a figure at this point that is like he's elevated to mythical proportions, that's not grounded in any reality.
Well, yep, but the reality is that so far he's making out like a bandit. He's getting what he wanted, isn't he?
Well, yes, he's getting a lot. I wouldn't be so sure that he hasn't hurt his own case by demanding so much. It would really be interesting. You'll never find out, I'm sure, neither one of us in any public sense, what is going on inside the mind of Senator Schumer, now the majority leader, when the governor keeps talking about this as if implicitly he's not, that Senator Schumer is not giving him enough. Mm-hmm. I think that, in fact, his rhetoric helped stiffen the spine of the Republican Senate last summer when they were inclined, by all accounts, including accounts I heard from inside, they were inclined to give the states another round of aid over the summer and into early fall. And then they dug in, and some of the fiscal hawks, or the erstwhile fiscal hawks among the Senate Republicans in Washington, began insisting that they wouldn't do any additional stimulus bill with aid, what they called a blue state bailout in it. And what they had in mind in the quote-unquote blue state bailout, which to be sure was a self-serving term of their own, but what they had in mind was New York in particular, and also Illinois. And I don't think the politics of this, I don't think that his approach to it and asking really high and demanding it again and again has necessarily been completely as productive as he wanted. I think early on we got a lot, and much of that $27 billion I talked about came early. But I think that as time went on over the summer and into the fall, I think that what he was saying and doing at that time became counterproductive. He was talking about this much more than any other governor, including the governor of California or the governors of New Jersey or Massachusetts, who also have a problem. And it's not communicating clearly to New Yorkers, or more to the point to the legislature, what the actual issue is. And in fact, I think it's been counterproductive in his own budget aims, but that's another issue.
Now, E.J. McMahon, let me ask you a couple of questions. First of all, he got extra powers, which the legislature wants to now take back. Can you talk about all of that for a minute?
I have not focused as much on that, except I think from the beginning, the people I know, and we looked at it at the Empire Center, and as even some lawmakers are pointing out today, it's not even clear he needed all of that, formalized all of that authority, that in law he already had enough. In the case of a public health emergency, he already had powers to do certain things that he needed to do. But there's a general push to restrict his power, and it's understandable. Although also you see quotes from lawmakers today suggesting that they understand that they don't want to be in the position of micromanaging how many people can be in a pizzeria in Queens, you know. I think that they don't like it, having handed him all this and walked away from it and essentially disappearing after last April. It's not an overstatement. They don't like his attitude. They don't like his temperament. They don't like the nursing home issue, which is, again, that's something my colleague Bill Hammond has been very much out front on. They don't like those things, but I'm not sure they want to be completely in charge themselves either.
I couldn't agree with you more. They gave them those powers. They wanted to stay home. They wanted to stay safe. And now, when it's convenient, they're asking for some of those powers back. Will they succeed?
Well, I mean, I think at this point he doesn't actually need all those powers, and I would hope, and I think whatever. To whatever extent they can restrict his ability to interfere with normal economic activity and to override state and local laws, that they should do it. I think it's a matter of them stepping up and exercising more responsibility themselves. It's akin to what they do in the budget issue, to turn the issue back to the budget for a minute. They've been complaining for years, different generations of them, he has too much budget power. They're largely wrong about that in terms of how they frame it. But number two, they don't even meet their own responsibilities under finance law. They don't do the reports they're supposed to do. They don't step up and produce their own revenue estimates. They don't do many of the things that the law requires them to do on their end of the budget making process. And yet they complain about him. So, and I mean him generically, all governors, because this started more under Pataki, in fact. So the legislature, again, I think his powers should be reduced in, as a general matter now. He doesn't need to have them all on the coronavirus issue. But also the legislature has a pattern of complaining about the governor's powers, even when it has its own responsibilities to meet and isn't meeting them.
Now, he was predicting, you know, a huge budget deficit. Now it turns out, miraculously, EJ, that there isn't going to be a deficit, that the budget will be balanced. What's that about?
Well, he was exaggerating the size of the budget deficit for pretty much almost from the start, and certainly it was clear by mid-year, which was last October, the end of last October, that he was wildly exaggerating the size of the budget gap. And as I said, he was doing it as if the world couldn't read the numbers. He was kept insisting that he should get $15 billion from the federal government. Sometimes he implied that number was not related to the budget, but related to some equally mythical sum of money we're supposedly paying in additional federal taxes due to the salt cap. But he wouldn't say whether it was 1 year or 2 years or $15 billion a year or $60 billion over 4 years. He used numbers almost interchangeably, but he used enormous numbers for months. But let me point out what he actually did, and back up a minute. Because of the way tax collections were coming in through October, the comptroller noted in the comptroller's own updated revenue forecast in November. By the way, the state comptroller, Tom DiNapoli, to his credit, has been the only player in the budget process who has consistently met his deadline for doing what he's supposed to do, which is limited in the financial planning process, every year for 10 or 11 years now. Nobody else has. So he predicted that actually revenues this year would be up $3.4 billion, higher than the governor was acknowledging then. He was correct. Every month of numbers we've had since then has shown DiNapoli was correct. Cuomo's belatedly caught up to him. Cuomo, as the law requires, last month proposed a balanced budget. So remember the phrase that was actually popularized by former comptroller Alan Hevesy with regard to the MTA? Remember the phrase, two sets of books? There's two sets of books. It's outrageous. There's two sets of books. Well, the governor is basically playing two, or depending on how you look at it, two or three different sets of books when he uses numbers about how big his current problem is. What he actually did was present a balanced budget, which he was required to do. The budget he proposed a month ago is balanced. It has no budget gap this year and no budget gap next year. Now, that's with the assumption that next year he assumes he's going to get $3 billion at a minimum, which he calls a worst-case scenario, in unrestricted federal aid from President Biden's stimulus bill. The bill that the House is about to pass gives him $12.7 billion. So he's in line to get four times that much. We'll see. But again, by the way, before you say you're indicating, wow, that sounds like he's doing pretty well, he also is continuing to demand $15 billion and not a penny less because, you know, he says so.
Well, that's smart, isn't it?
I think it's also transparent.
To you.
Huh?
To you,
well, no,
as opposed to the public who have no idea what the budget is, what's in it, and any of the other stuff.
Well, here's the thing, okay? He's not using this, as governors traditionally would have, to say, we've got a big problem, we can't afford to spend as much as you guys over there want. That's a more or less traditional gubernatorial role, because the buck stops with the governor. It doesn't matter what party he or she is in or anything else. In this case, he has so wildly, repeatedly, in some cases grossly exaggerated how much how big the problem is that he actually has stoked the flames of the progressives and the people on the left who are proposing an enormous, unprecedented radical tax agenda that's beyond several orders of magnitude, beyond anything ever seen or conceived of in New York State. And they were proposing this before the pandemic, but now they're saying, see, we need this because the governor says we need $60 billion or 15 or whatever number they want to use. And so I think that what he's done more than anything is he's confused people. A governor has an obligation to lower expectations and to be cautious and to not let people think we've got more than we have. But what he's doing, he also has an obligation, I think, to honestly inform his constituents and the legislature. And in this case, while if you actually read the financial plan documents, which actually have to be fairly clean and honest for financial market purposes, you can see in there that what the actual situation is, which is different than what he portrays. It's not great, by the way, but in the short term, it's fine, and only in the short term. But he's having it both ways, and I think he's basically persuaded most people. If I've seen it once, I've seen it repeated in news stories and other places, you know, 100 times, that we have a, quote, $15 billion deficit. Well, we don't have a $15 billion deficit. There is no deficit right now, and the budget he's proposed has no deficit. What's problem is that he allowed spending to continue at a rate that he knew the state could not afford starting last April. And we had an advantage, and remember, other states were stuck only 3/4 of the way through their fiscal year. They had a whole fiscal quarter in which they were spending too much as the pandemic hit them. And if they had been adopting their budgets earlier, they would have done more to control spending, most of them.
But EJ, doesn't it prove that the guy's a political genius? You may not like it, but he didn't pull in his horns. He didn't say you can't spend as much, basically, although he did in some ways. He said, you know, we're withholding 20%. But isn't he a genius in that he comes out of this looking clean and not having punished anybody fiscally?
No, I disagree very strongly about that. I think he's politically clumsy and crude, and that this is going to come back to bite him, and already is.
Who, Andrew Cruz?
He is consistently, I think that he's repeatedly undermined his own credibility. I think that he has created a much bigger problem for the future. He was actually concerned about the long term. And if anybody should be concerned about the long term, it should be the governor, especially someone who makes no secret of the fact that he wants to be governor through 2027 or into 2027, that he should be concerned about the long term issue. And he's playing games. I think he's doing it for transparent purposes. I don't think it even serves his own political advantage. I think it's just crude. It's a transparent effort to try to continue claiming he needs much more than he needs in the short term, as if it's fooling anybody, and it isn't. His intended audience in Washington doesn't believe him to begin with, including the Democrats, by the way. And I don't think it's actually working in his favor. I think that ultimately, like I said, I think he has stoked the flames of everybody who is now saying, see, we need to do the biggest tax increase any state has ever seen in history. And I think it's been very counterproductive.
Talk to me a little bit, if you would, about the deduction of state and local taxes. He harps on that a good deal. He's talking about it all the time.
Right.
Have we really been damaged, and will the Biden administration restore it?
Well, that's a very good question. That's a very timely question. And here's a multi-part answer. A, I think he understands what the actual problem is. The actual problem with the state and local tax deduction and the cap on the state and local tax deduction, which is $10,000, is essentially means there's no state and local tax deduction for most of the people who used to take it. Now, here's the issue he has. For the vast majority of New Yorkers, by which I mean more than 90%, the total effect of all the changes in the 2017 federal tax law change have yielded lower taxes. That includes suburban homeowners who were deducting $20,000 in taxes. All of the other changes, the rate changes, the rollback of the alternative minimum tax, the increase in standard deduction, the increase in the child credit, have resulted in the fact that the vast majority of New Yorkers are paying lower taxes now, and they will in their new tax return, than they did before that law was done. Full disclosure, I can't emphasize this enough. I didn't like that law. I thought it was poorly structured, and I think from a conservative federalist standpoint, capping state and local tax deductions is a bad thing. So I disagree with, I don't like that policy. I agree with the governor on that. However, this is another area when his politics have driven him to misrepresent something. He has repeatedly misrepresented this as a broad problem that is forcing New Yorkers to pay more in taxes. He flat out explicitly said last year, several times, he's like upped his ante. We're paying $15 billion more every year, $30 billion over 2 years. That's $30 billion in cash. I remember the words. I've almost memorized them. $30 billion more we've paid. Alan, that's simply untrue. The statistics are out for tax year 2018. New Yorkers paid less in total taxes in 2018 than they did in 2017 in federal income tax. That's the fact. What Cuomo's worried about is our tax code is extremely heavily dependent on a relatively small number of people who make millions of dollars in income, the famous top 1%. We are more dependent on our income tax and in turn more dependent on multimillionaire earners than any state except California in combination. They pay 44, the state resident share of income tax, the top 1% pays 44% of all income tax paid by state residents, just 1% of the tax filers. The bottom 30%, by the way, bottom 40% pays nothing.
Okay, you've made that point. We only have a couple of minutes, so I wanted to ask you real fast.
Right.
Number one, $15 minimum wage.
It already exists in New York City. Upstate, the minimum wage has been repeatedly increased, and he had let it increase again in December in the midst of an economic crisis. The $15 minimum wage, at best, is a solution that is really clumsy to apply to a bunch of regional economies in which wage levels and productivity wildly varies. It's ultimately going to cost people job opportunities, even while it increases the pay of those who do remain employed or get a job when the economy recovers. It's a bad idea.
Okay, we got a census now. Economic growth, obviously, is a question.
Yeah.
So is there any relationship between that census and economic growth?
The census doesn't affect or drive economic growth. I'd say no. The problem with the census is it's not going to be accurate. It almost is certain not to be accurate because of the weirdness of the year in which it was taken. So we're going to lose two congressional seats probably, which has to do with congressional influence. It'll also influence in the state's redistricting in weird ways. But the real problem is that we won't really have a clean handle on actual census numbers in the decennial census because the whole timing and nature of it was so weird.
E.J. McMahon, we love having you on. It's great to know you're out there looking at things. And, you know, people may call you a conservative. Nevertheless, somebody's got to keep an eye on things, and you are doing that, and we appreciate it so much.
Well, thank you. And conservative is not necessarily a bad word on its own either, by the way. But that's
not
a whole
necessarily.
Other, except for maybe some of this audience. To you, maybe. So anyway, thank you very much.